Well, so what we're doing now, just we'll do from now between Pesach and Shavuos for the next 6 weeks, is to learn Pirkei Avos, because this year, actually, when my wife was sitting Shiva 8 months ago, we went to, her father was buried in Jerusalem at Har HaZeisim, and she sat Shiva for 1 day in a hotel in Yerushalayim, and Rav Asher Weiss came to be Menachem Avel. And when he came to visit her, he brought his new book, his commentary on Pirkei Avos. Right now, this is what I have here, what he brought. And I think it's actually coming out in English as well, he told us. I don't know if it's out already, but he said it's going to. And the reason he brought it is because he said that, you know, his wife died, maybe it's 5 years ago now or so, and she was in her mid-60s. And to Lezecher Nishmasa, in memory of her, with the family, they were learning. But they were learning, like, very complicated. He told me that the kids weren't so into it, like with his grandkids. And they asked for something easier and something more interesting. So he said, okay, how about if we learn Pirkei Avos? And he said his family got so into it, every Saturday night, every Motzei Shabbos, they would learn Pirkei Avos together. And they got so into it, and they liked what he was saying so much that they decided to write it up and turn it into a book. So in her memory, they published this book. Actually, we co-sponsored it. See, us, Cedar Sinai. If you look on the inside cover, you see a list of synagogues and one hospital that co-sponsored the book, and that's Cedar Sinai, that's us. So this is Rav Asher Weiss on Pirkei Avos. We'll do one chapter a week or so up until Shavuos. Can I have one of the sheets? Actually, I gave up too many. It's just because I want you to have the Pirkei Avos in front of you. It's not his commentary, it's not on these sheets. I just want you to have the actual Mishnah in front of you as we analyze each one. But the first question always is, you know, so Pirkei Avos is a Masechet of Mishnah. There's no Gemara on it, but it's Mishnah in Seder Nezikin. And it's just, you know, wise sayings of the Tanaim, of our great rabbis. And then he has a lot of commentary here. But so one of the questions is, why is it called Avos? Avos, Avot means fathers. Why Pirkei Avot? What does it have to do with fathers? Why is that the name of it? So he has two interesting comments. One is, he says, you know, when it comes to making decisions in Judaism, Jewish law, we're looking for a source in the Torah. We're looking for a source in the Shulchan Aruch in someplace. But when it comes to midos, just sort of ethical behavior and general personality traits and how you should act to other people, he says, with that, we look to our ancestors. And we need to decide between two different perspectives, or like what's the right thing to do. Look to our ancestors, especially look to our avos, look to the way the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, you know, how and so on, how they acted in the Torah. We learn from them. So therefore, that's why it's called Pirkei Avos. But then he has a really interesting comment that he actually goes on for a couple of pages, which I thought this was really fascinating, because you always wonder, you know, when we talk about Mesorah, we talk about how it's so important to have tradition, that the Torah is passed on generation to generation. But does that mean that, like, if you ask a rabbi a question, a great rabbi, does that mean that the answer they gave you, they know it because it was passed from Moses until them? Like, I even had a rabbi, actually, when I was in Israel for the year, after high school in 1998, I remember I had a rabbi that gave us a chart of every rabbi from Moses till him. And he was like, you're now part of that. See this? And that's his authority, right? Is that I have a direct line to Moses, which it wasn't that long. It was like, you know, 80 rabbi, maybe even less. It wasn't the longest. Although, you know, you could, whatever. There's maybe some rabbis in there in that chain that, you know, I'm not sure that it went directly person to person. But what Rav Asher Weiss writes here is that, you know, on the one hand, the Bartanura actually argues that when it comes to character traits, the reason why it's called Pirkei Avos is to teach you that it's not just the Torah that was handed down person to person, also proper character traits were passed down person to person from Moshe until your rabbis today, to us today. That's what he says. Even character traits, not just the Torah, not just what's kosher, what's not kosher, but also how to act. Rav Asher Weiss says, you know, I'm not so convinced by that. He says, I'm not sure that's what it means. He says, the truth is, it's not that every single thing that a rabbi says is that they got from Moses. What they got, though, is they have general principles. In fact, I'll read you his words. He says, "Shelo chidshu ma shechidshu ela al hayosodos shekiblu mirabaseim dor achar dor ad l'Moshe Rabbeinu." There's general principles that they learn, and that's how they apply it. For example, I was talking to a friend of mine who just returned from serving in the military, the American military, and I was telling him about this. We were just talking. I told him this idea, and he said, "Oh, we have that in the military. There's a thing called commander's intent." And sometimes when you're in the battlefield and you can't know exactly what to do, you can't expect that your commander told you everything. But as long as you act within your commander's intent, then you're considered to be behaving ethically in the military. The commander's intent is the commander trains you and teaches you. You try to go through as many scenarios as possible to understand what they want from you, and then you do your best to apply it. But the commander can't predict every single thing that's going to happen. So you have their intent. And that's what he argues the rabbis were doing, was we have principles and traditions that we pass on, and that's what we are, that's what the rabbis were passing on. In fact, he says that this is the Chazon Ish. He didn't just make this up. The Chazon Ish writes in one place, the rabbis said that Rabbeinu Hananel, everything he says is Divrei Kabbalah. It's all tradition. Rabbeinu Hananel lived in the 11th century in Italy. It's all tradition, like straight from the rabbis. Does that mean that he had a tradition that went back directly? Then it was only 1,000 years. But from him to these great rabbis? So the Chazon Ish himself wrote, no. When they said Divrei Kabbalah, it meant Dor Achar Dor, Shekad Mulo, that every generation, Aval Ein Ezeh Koveh Shehen Devarim Mekubali Michach Me'agamar. It doesn't mean that he got it. In fact, he writes in one place, he says, Divrei Kabbalah hainu midor or dorot shekad mulo. It's either one or two generations before him that he got it, and it's like principles that he received, but not necessarily that he got these exact words that went generation to generation. However, Rav Asher Weiss writes, there's nothing that these rabbis would say that Moshe would disagree with. Meaning, Moshe, she'en lecha davar betor she'nel la mi'enev shel Moshe. We might not have gotten it word from Moshe, but Moshe knew what we were going to say. It's because it's within the tradition of what Moshe passed down. And sometimes we have the famous story, like, for example, Rabbi Akiva, that Moshe listened to his lecture, and he was like, I never heard this before. And then they said to Moshe, they said to Rabbi Akiva, where'd you get this? He says, halacha l'Moshe Mesinai. To Moshe, Moshe's like, what? He's like, no, it's not that you taught those exact words, but those are the principles that you passed down. And so he didn't make it up straight. You know, Moshe would have agreed with that. Anyways, that's his general introduction to what Pirkei Avos is. I thought it was just so interesting to think about, you know, this concept of, you know, where does the tradition come from and how exactly do you pass it over? It is, of course, the tradition, the direct tradition, but, the principles, the general principles. So now I think I put on your sheet there the first one. That was the first Mishnah. Now we go to Mishnah 12. No, I'm sorry. Stay in Mishnah Aleph. There's just a lot of pages. The first Mishnah, still in the first Mishnah, it says, Asu siyag l'Torah. Make a fence for the Torah. By the way, there's a great joke about that. Why do the rabbis want to have a fence for the Torah? Because that will create a safer Torah. Safer Torah. Yeah, they want to have a safer Torah. So anyways, what does it mean, siyag l'Torah? This, I thought, was a really interesting insight. This, Rav Asher Weiss writes that he heard from his father many times an interesting insight on what does it mean to make a fence for the Torah. He says, the rabbis made two fences for the Torah that without those two fences, Judaism as we know it would not be the Judaism today that we know of. It would be the Judaism that we know of today is because of these two fences. Two things that the rabbis instituted that created the Judaism of today. You want to guess? Yeah, you know, two derabbanos, two rabbinic laws that the rabbis instituted that without them we would have lost so much. He's like, thank God the rabbis were so brilliant to have these two things. Number one was what? Well, what aspects? Right, what aspects of the oral law? What aspects of the derabbanos? So, number one, he says that the siddur. that they created, the Anshe Knesset Gedolah created specific text of a prayer book. Because, you know, from the Torah, technically you only have to daven when it comes to you, when it's sorrow, when you feel the emotions. You just cry out to God. But the rabbis created, the three times a day, the specific text of the Siddur. And because we have three times a day prayers, and we have certain prayers we need to say, and we need a minyan, and things like that, and we have, you know, responsive prayers, so we had to therefore have synagogues. Because of the set prayers is why synagogues developed. So it's like, imagine Judaism today without prayers and synagogues. Like, it's become what has kept us together as a Jewish people throughout all these years, that we have synagogues to go to, places of gathering, prayers that we all... You can go to any kind of synagogue. You know, I love doing this when I'm in Israel, just going to a synagogue that's from a totally different, you know, going to like a Moroccan synagogue or a Yemenite synagogue or something. And even though it is very different, we can still, you can still follow along. There is the basic same text and the same structure, and that has kept us Jewish. Yeah.
Is that also where minyan tie in?
Like, yeah. The whole idea of needing a minyan. You technically wouldn't need to have a minyan to pray, but the rabbis instituted this whole set of what you need to have a minyan to pray with. You know, certain prayers, you have to have a minyan for them, and we have set prayers. So, like, this created the need for synagogues. That's one thing that strengthened Judaism, Jewish identity, Jewish continuity, was having synagogues. Number two, that's positive. On the negative side, there's something called shvusim, shvus on Shabbos. The rabbinic prohibitions on Shabbos, specifically three. The three are, that he mentions, are, let's see if I can remember them without looking at them. He says that they are the carmelis, the concept of not being allowed to carry in certain places, also muksa, the concept of muksa, certain things you can't carry, and here, I just want to make sure I want to get all three of them. Muksa, carmelis, what? Anyone want to guess the third one about Shabbos? Do you see where I'm going with this? See where he's going? Yeah, that's with the cart with carrying. Okay, here it is. Here's where he says it. So he says, this one was just a little different because it's technically mentioned in Tanakh. That's why I didn't think of this one. That meschar, mekach and memchar, doing business, even if it's not necessarily something that would be obviously prohibited, but doing business. So the fact that we have a prohibition against carrying in certain semi-public places and doing business and carrying muksa items, carrying things that you can't use anyways on Shabbos, that changed everything. Why? We know that from the Torah, you can't build and destroy. Binyan and stira. You can't build and destroy. You also can't harvest and plow and do agriculture and garden and work the fields, you know, farm. So that were people's professions, either building or farming. So if you can't build or farm, you can't do those things, you can't work on Shabbos, so what are you going to do the whole day? So the rabbis realized that people are going to, since they're going to have a free day, they are going to do errands, basically. It'll be the day for errands. Go to the shuk, get your shopping done, go do your errands. But the rabbis wanted to make sure that Shabbos is a meaningful day. And not just a day of rest. That Shabbos is not just meant to be a day of rest. It's more meaningful than that. So they realized the rabbi said we have to make sure that they're not just running around doing business. So they limited that. And therefore Shabbos became Vayinafash. It became a day for spiritual connection. You know, thank God that's maybe why rabbis in the more modern era thought of like electricity as seeing that as being a type of something that's to be concerned about as well, because otherwise we would be on our iPhones or, you know, all day on Shabbos and it wouldn't be the same. So anyways, his father would say that Siag LaTorah, making offense to the Torah, the rabbis were brilliant in creating set prayers, which made our synagogues, and prohibiting business-like activities that enables us to actually enjoy Shabbos and have it as a meaningful day of spirituality. Okay, next one. This one I thought was especially beautiful. So the next Mishnah you have there is now Mishnah 12. So Mishnah 12 said, Hillel v'shamai kiblu mihem, Hillel omer, havi me talmidev sha'aron, ohev shalom v'rodev shalom, ohev esabrios u'mekarvan l'torah. So two interesting comments he has on this. First, ohev shalom v'rodev shalom. So it says the rabbi said that Gadol Hashalom Shekola Torah Nitna Lasos Shalom Be'Olam Shneamar Darchei Darchei Noam, and then it says Ve'Ein Kli Machzik Bracha Ella Shalom. There's no utensil that will hold blessing better than peace. What does that mean? What were the rabbis talking about? They said peace is a utensil for blessing. So he says, you know, nowadays we're so rich, we don't realize how wealthy the world is. If you want to buy a soda, do you have to bring your own bottle? Obviously, water, it comes already in the bottle. If you want to buy wine, it comes in the bottle. If you want to buy grapes, they come in a bag. Like, it used to be that you had to bring your own bags. I guess we do that now today. Also, like, you bring your own bag. You don't use plastic bags. But even for the stuff that holds it, like, if you wanted to buy peanut butter, at least that comes in a bottle, right? You had to bring your own. You go to the store and you bring your own stuff. But imagine you go and you go to the best wine cellar in the Shuk, and you're like, you have some napkins. You're like, here, pour the wine in the napkin, and I'll bring it home. They're like, they're probably going to be like, what are you crazy? Like, I'm not going to pour my wine into the napkin. You're going to lose it all. Like, you have to have a good. You have to have a good container. And he says that they would send you home. They wouldn't even give you their product if they could see that your container's not going to carry it. So he says. So when it comes to humanity, God also wants to give us. God wants to be giving to us and providing for us. But we have to have a receptacle to carry it in. And the way we make ourselves a receptacle is bracha, is by through shalom. The way we get shalom, bracha is through shalom. Ein kli machzik bracha. There's no utensil that holds blessing from God, ella shalom, other than peace. Peace is the ultimate. If we're people that are peaceful people, that are ensuring peace, helping to promote peace, creating peace, then we get bracha from God. It's sort of like, I already told somebody this today because I found it so moving. Yesterday was Yom HaShoah, and this morning, I was thinking yesterday about how I never see people with numbers tattooed on their arms anymore. Like, and I used to, every day, constantly, I'm sure others you can relate. I used to, every patient, I was constantly meet patients. Every day I'd meet patients with tattooed numbers on their arms. And yesterday at the Yom HaShoah event, where we only had one survivor in the room until someone else turned out to be there was a second survivor. But of the whole place, we used to have lots of survivors that would come up. We didn't have enough to light the candle. We had too many to light the candles. Meaning, how would we choose? We had to do like three at a time. We have so few survivors. So I was just thinking like how sad it is. I don't remember. It's been more than a year since I've seen a patient with a number on their arm. Then this morning, the first patient that I saw, 100 years old, she had a number on her arm. So I immediately said to her, "Can you give me a blessing?" Because you know they say the Satmar Rebbe that you know someone they said someone once went to him and asked him for a bracha, and he said, "No, go ask a survivor for a bracha. Someone with a tattoo number on their arm, they'll give you much better bracha." So I asked this patient for a bracha, and she said to me, "You don't need my bracha." She's like, "No, I said I want your bracha." She said, "No, to get a bracha anyways is just be kind to other people and God will be kind to you. That's the bracha. Be kind to people and then God's kind to you." I thought that was so beautiful. And that's what Rav Asher Weiss is saying. We can be a receptacle for peace, for bracha, if we promote peace and pursue peace. The other thing it said in that Mishnah is, "Ohe v'sabrios umekarvan the Torah." Love people and bring them to the Torah. So he points out that it doesn't say, you know, people might think it means, oh, I have to like be trying to convince everyone to be observant and I have to love them so that I have to be nice to them so that will force them to, you know, kiruv, you know, to force them to be observant. But he says, notice that it doesn't say, shelo amru, oy vesabrios, le karvam la Torah. Don't love people in order to make them more observant. That's not true love. That's not really loving someone if you're saying, I'm going to be nice to them because then that will make them like me better, like Judaism better. You have to love someone, you have to... Avas Yisrael, loving others, is meant to be, it has to be true. Being non-judgmental is about actually being not, like, you have to actually work on that in yourself to actually show, to actually feel a sense of love for other people, respect for other people. It can't be that it's for the sake of something else. So he tells a story, for example, he says, you know the Chabad guys that are always out trying to, like, put on tefillin on people? So he says, here's like a mushel. Two people are walking, and they pass some Chabad guys, and they say, "Hey, you want to put on tefillin?" And they both say, "Yeah, no thanks, not interested." So they keep walking. Then they see another Chabad guy, and he says, "Hey, would you like to put on tefillin?" So the other one guy says, "Yeah, no, still not interested." The other one says, "Yeah, okay, you know what, sure, I'll put on tefillin." So he puts on the tefillin. So then the other one asks his friend, why did you say no to that one and yes to that one? He said, the first one, I saw that he just wanted to get like points. He was going to take a selfie with me and try to show off like, oh, look who how many people I put tefillin on today. And just like, for him, it was just like, I was just like another number. But the other guy, for some reason, I saw that he like cared if I haven't put on tefillin. And he had cared about me. And so I thought, you know what, if he cares about me, then I'm willing to do it. So that's where Rusher Weiss says, you're supposed to actually care about the person. And then, like he says, I was once speaking to a group of teachers and they asked, I asked them, what's the number one criteria you need to have to be a good teacher? So someone raised his hand and said, oh, you have to be a big Talmud Chacham. You have to know a lot of Torah. Obviously, you have to be an expert. If you're going to be a teacher, you have to know everything. Another one said, oh, you have to prepare very well. So another one, and he said, you know what? I'll tell you, those are all great, important things. But the number one thing you need to be a good teacher is to love your students. If you love your students, then you'll be able to be a good teacher. That's the only way to really make sure that you'll be able to have a positive impact. So that's what he says about, and I thought, you know, knowing him, knowing Rav Asher Weiss, he's such a loving person, such a caring person, such a big heart that, like, when I read that, it's like, coming from him, you know, I accept it. I think it's really special. The next Mishnah, if you go to, it's Mishnah 14, Hu Haya Omer, still hello? Im ein ani li mili, if I'm not for myself, right? Very famous Mishnah. If I'm not for myself, who will be for me? Ukshani latsmi, if I'm just for myself, mani, then what am I? Vim lo achshav emasai, and if not now, when? So that's the famous Mishnah. Rav Asher Weiss has a comment here that's actually not his own insight, but he just quotes it. But I just thought it was so cool. I had never heard this before. He quotes the Baal Shem Tov, and if you notice, if you look at these words, the Baal Shem Tov points out the word ein and ani are the same letters. Aleph, Yud, Nun. Right? Just different order. The exact same letters. But in a way, they're opposites. The opposite words of each other. Because ain, especially in Hasidic literature, is like the ayin. Like, I'm nothing. I'm nothing. Trying to be, just the nachnuma. I try to see myself as being nothing. I'm ain. That's the ultimate way to become close to God, is to remove your ego completely. No ego. But on the other hand, ani. The ani is like a sense of purpose and confidence. And I am somebody. I can accomplish. So he says, everyone has both sides. Which, by the way, if you think about it, I mean, Rabbi Meir of blessed memory would be, I'm sure, would have a lot to say about this. You know, Freud was famous for having the superego and the id. Right? That was this whole Freudian thing. Like, on the one hand, everyone has their superego that encourages them to, like, accomplish and then do new things. And then their id, their most base, you know, aspects. And the truth is, this is he quotes here, the Rebbe Bunamim Pshischa, who used to say that on the one hand, you should put in one pocket the statement of the Talmud. What? Right. That's how I heard it. That I'm dust and ashes. He quotes it here saying, Yatush Kadmeich, where in the Gemara says, you should remind yourself that the mosquito in the 6 days of creation, even the mosquito is created before you. Like, you're nothing. But yes, I heard it that way, that I'm just ashes and dust, or I'm a return ashes and dust, or that I'm just, you know, I'm worth less than a mosquito. But then you put in your other pocket at the same time, Bishvili Nivra Olam. The world is created for me, and you're supposed to, like, balance the two. Recognizing, on the one hand, your humility, like, I'm not such a big deal. On the other hand, you can accomplish. You have to have some sense of self-confidence. And he says, if the Baal Shem Tov said, if you can do that, im eina nili, then mili, then you can be something. Because, first of all, you can become a me, you can become, I'm somebody, I can be somebody if I can have confidence, but also proper modesty and humility. But me is also, in Hasidic and Kabbalistic literature, it adds up to 50. Mem is 40, Yud is 10, so that's 50. And there's a concept in Hasidic literature of the Chamishim Shari Bina, 50 levels of wisdom or insight. And someone who can recognize that they are nothing at the same time as they recognize that they are something, that they can have true wisdom, which I thought was a really interesting. And maybe, you know, by the way, that's in the name of the Baal Shem Tov. Freud, great-grandfather was a rabbi. So even though he was a very secular Jew, who knows? Maybe someone could do a PhD dissertation trying to find, you know, Freud's rabbinic influence. Yeah.
I bought a book from the library.
Yeah.
I haven't read it yet. I've just, like, looked.
What's it called?
Like,
Kabbalah and Freud, really?
Yeah, I bought a bunch of Freud.
So we have to check if that if it says something about this.
The argument is that did actually have an influence. Judaism had an influence over his ideas. Uh-huh. And he actually would show up at early on in his career, he showed up at the neighborhood
event. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
People think that Freud was super secular, but
right. That he did have rabbinic or Jewish influence. Okay, so maybe this whole teaching right here from the Baal Shem Tov influenced Freud. So you never know. That's cool. Okay, so just one more I have here. It's two from the last couple of Mishnahs. So they're short ones. But so the next Mishnah says Shammai Omer. This is Mishnah 15. Asay Taraska Keva, make your Torah study fixed. Omer Meyat V'asay Arbeid, say little but do much. And then Havi Mekabas Kol Adam Sefer Panim Yafos, and greet everyone with a pleasant countenance. So he says something on this one that is really interesting and actually could be somewhat controversial depending on how you want to take it. But he talks about how everyone's supposed to have Kvias Itim LaTorah. In fact, it's not just that you're supposed to, but it's that, the six questions, that the Talmud says six questions will be asked. The Gemara says that there's six questions you'll be asked. Everyone's going to be asked Shabbos, Lamed Aleph, Gemara and Shabbos. First one is, Nesat Mesata Bemuna, did you do business honestly? Next question, Kivata Itin LaTorah, did you set aside time for studying Torah? So clearly all of you have set aside time for studying Torah. Tuesdays at noon is a perfect time to do that. But the question is, did you set aside time for studying Torah? So Rav Asher Weiss then says, an interesting thing. I'm going to read you something, and then we'll conclude with one last point. The Birchei Yosef, commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, says as follows. Dayan Hamamuna Ladun, let's say someone is a judge, a dayan in a Jewish rabbinic court. Mutar Ladun Be'ez HaKavua Lo Lilmod. Let's say they have a set time for learning Torah. Can they stop learning Torah in order to judge a case? Yes. Why? Well, it's their job and it's Torah. That's not stopping Torah. Like if you're stopping learning in order to actually put it into practice, that's Torah. Okay, great. So he says, Va'ola lo lumod. And in fact, that counts as his Torah learning. Dedina hainu Torah. Then is Torah. V'hainu dafka kishenu notas schar ladun. But he then says, that's only if he's not being paid to judge. If he's being paid to be a dayan, he doesn't get credit for learning in that time. Mehai taima nami milame tinokos beschar. So to someone who's teaching Torah to children, being paid for it, eino ola lekavius itim Torah. That does not count as a kavius itim. Meaning, it's still good. It's still Torah. But when it says you have to set aside time to learn Torah, that's time that you're not paid for it. And the pizza that you're eating that you get for this doesn't count. That's not because you get to eat lunch anyways. But it's not, if you're paid for it, it doesn't necessarily count. So then he concludes, the Birchei Yosef says, so therefore someone who learns in yeshiva and gets paid to learn, they have to then take some other time that they're not being paid for and learn Torah. They want to have Kviyas Itim. You can imagine you have someone who learns in Kolel 18 hours a day. Imagine they show up to God, they get these six questions, and one of you, let's say, is next in line. And they say, did you set aside time for Torah? He says, what are you talking about? I learned 18 hours a day in Kolel and Yerushalayim. And he then says to one of you, did you set aside time? He says, yeah, 45, half an hour a week, I learned with Rabbi Weiner. God's going to say, I may be biased in this, the one that you literally half an hour, you fulfilled Kvat Ibn Torah. You learned 18 hours a day. Did you fulfill it? Now, of course, I'm not belittling someone who learns 18 hours a day. And Rav Asher Weiss himself says, that's the greatest thing. They're learning Torah all day. That's the greatest thing. There's no mitzvah like that. It's amazing. But in terms of this separate mitzvah of finding set times for learning Torah, they don't necessarily fulfill that if they're being paid for it. They also have to find time. And he says, you have these guys that learn in an early morning kolel boker to get extra pay, and late night kolel. They have to still find extra time besides what they're not being paid for. They have to find some time to learn. So that was an interesting, provocative statement. Again, he's very careful not to belittle people learning kolel. That's great. And obviously, they're making much less money than they could be making if they were working a job. But it's just interesting concept that setting aside special times for Torah, that's what you're not paid for. That's what makes it especially meaningful. Though, there's a lot of people that I know pay people to learn Torah in order to inspire them. Okay, last thing. last piece, I thought this was interesting. It wraps it up. It kind of brings it all full circle with what we started out with. So the last Mishnah there, if you notice, we're not actually studying the topic of the Mishnah, but if you look at it, now says, Rabban Gamliel Haya Omer. Do you know something different between Hillel, Shammai, and Rabban Gamliel between the names? Notice the difference there? Yeah, the title. So far we've had, you know, Shmaya Vavtalion, Hillel Vashammai. They don't have titles. Now, and they're always Zugos. This is the period of the Zugos. You have these pairs of rabbis in this first Mishnah, the first parak of the Mishnah you have. But you had. But then all of a sudden, now we get, you know, Rabban Yochum and Zakkai, Rabban Gamliel. They all of a sudden have titles. Rabbi. Why do they need titles? Why did that happen all of a sudden? Why did the first few rabbis not have titles, and now they have titles? What happened? So there's different explanations. His is really interesting. For example, Midrash Shmuel says, "Shegadol haya biyadul lechadesh Torah." It was because to show that he was great and he was able to come up with new ideas. So he had to get Rabban. He says that he quotes here another insight, the Rambam, that it says. The first ones, the first rabbis, no, they were greater, and they were so great, like Hillel, Shammai, they were so great that there isn't a title. There's no good enough title for them.
Their name is
their title. Their name is their title, exactly. So that's good, although we give like Moshe Rabbeinu a title, like you know, that's good enough for Moshe, why isn't it good enough for them? I don't know, that's what Rambam says. He says, I have a different insight, which is beautiful and just fits into who he is and what I've said so far. He says, if it was up to me, he says it very modestly, if it was up to me, I would say that what happened was, until this time, meaning the rabbis who didn't have titles, there was such love for their rabbis and such love for the Torah that that it was like a big family. He says, Rabbanan v'talmidehen hayu mamish k'mishpacha gadola. It was like one big family because they just had this great love for the Torah. And that's like what the rabbi said. V'shinantam levanecha, should teach your children. What does it mean, your children? Elu hatalmidim. That's your students. And because of their great love and their great, you know, regard for the Torah and their closeness with each other, they just called them by their names. Because like in your family, my kids don't call me rabbi. They call me other things. No, I'm joking. But they don't, obviously my kid, you know, you don't call, if your parent's a doctor, I don't think you call your parent doctor. Like, you don't call your family or your brother or sister or whatever. You don't call your family members by titles. So that's why they didn't have titles, because they were like a family. They didn't use titles because they were so close. And even you have sometimes, after them, you had some like Abba Chalafta. You had certain rabbis that they referred to almost just as parents. So then he says, but unfortunately, what happened was Yerida Sadoros. The generations declined, and it got worse. And the love wasn't. There's still a great love for Torah, of course, but the love wasn't the same level of love and the same level of closeness and attachment that they had in previous generations. So therefore they had titles because there was a little bit of a distance. Titles show distance, and that's why they started using the titles. In a certain way, a little bit negative. Like, obviously, we show respect by using someone's title, but it's there was some distance developing between the rabbis and the students, and that's where the titles came in, which I think is interesting. But it shows like how much love for Torah there was. That it was like a family. It's really a beautiful way of seeing it. So these were the insights for this week of Rav Asher Weiss for the first chapter of Pirkei Avos, and next week we'll go to see what he has in chapter 2, which is a lot of really beautiful stuff.